Hi, this is Billy Idol. You're listening to Everything Fab Four on Salon.com.
Welcome to Everything Fab Four, a podcast focused on fun and intelligent stories about the Beatles. I'm your host, Ken Womack, music culture columnist for Salon.com and a Beatles scholar and historian. No other band, or popular phenomenon for that matter, has enjoyed the global impact the Beatles have and continue to have more than 50 years later. They are part of our human fabric. They created music that continues to bring people together, and just about everyone has their own Beatles story to tell, some that are surprisingly deep and unexpected. This show seeks to draw those stories out in interesting and insightful ways. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.
I went over to George and I sat down in a booth. The photographer got a picture of me listening to George talk, because George was the only one talking. He was the only one who could speak at that moment, because I couldn't. And I remember him saying, "Have you been to Disneyland?" You know, and I just trying to get me to form words. And I was just in awe of this guy and what he had gone through and been through, that level of fame.
Today's guest is Jeff Daniels, celebrated actor of stage and screen, and a diehard, unapologetic Beatles fan. Over the years, Daniels has demonstrated a wide-ranging style while working with some of the world's most revered filmmakers. Jeff made his screen debut in Milos Forman's Ragtime. In short order, he starred in James L. Brooks's Terms of Endearment, Woody Allen's The Purple Rose of Cairo, and Mike Nichols' Heartburn. Across his five-decade-long career, he has starred in a variety of genre films, including Gettysburg, Speed, Dumb and Dumber, 101 Dalmatians, and Pleasantville. Daniels has been nominated for numerous Golden Globe and Screen Actors Awards for his dramatic turns, including such films as Jonathan Demme's Something Wild and Noah Baumbach's The Squid and the Whale. He has also starred in critically acclaimed films such as The Hours, Good Night and Good Luck, Looper, and The Martian. In 2012, Daniels joined the cast of HBO's political drama, The Newsroom, which earned him a Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series. Playing Will McAvoy, Daniels' monologue about American exceptionalism in the series' pilot has been viewed more than 22 million times on YouTube. His acclaimed work in episodic TV also includes his portrayal of John O'Neill in the Hulu miniseries The Looming Tower and FBI director James Comey in Showtime's The Comey Rule. In 1977, Daniels made his Broadway debut in Gemini, later earning Tony Award nominations for his roles in Yasmina Reza's God of Carnage, David Harrower's Blackbird, and, most recently, Aaron Sorkin's To Kill a Mockingbird. A dyed-in-the-wool Midwesterner, Daniels is the founder and executive director of Chelsea, Michigan's Purple Rose Theater Company. This week will mark the world premiere of the Netflix miniseries A Man in Full, in which he stars as Charlie Croker in the adaptation of Tom Wolfe's vaunted novel about the ills of greed and social intrigue. Welcome, Jeff Daniels. Tell me about your own Beatles story. When does that start? When does this love of the Beatles start? I understand you ate up the new Get Back docuseries and at one point work on a film with George Harrison.
Yeah. I remember I was in fourth grade when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And you could feel a change in the room, and it was fourth grade girls. In the fourth grade, they were like, you know, in love with these, you know, mop tops. And it wasn't till later on, I think, probably Sgt. Pepper, Abbey Road, you know, the Let It Be album, that I really kind of, you know, went for him. I was very into Elton John, and it was either Elton John or Arlo Guthrie, which is quite a wide range. But in between there was the Beatles and what they had done to change everything. Years later, I in 1988, I got an independent movie called Checking Out. And David Leland was the director, and he had worked with Monty Python a little bit. And the producers on it were Dennis O'Brien and George Harrison. It was whatever the name of that. I can't remember the name of that film company they had.
Handmade Films.
Handmade Films, that's it. We were shooting in L.A., and George came to the set. And you heard that he was coming to the set. Today, he's coming to the set. And we were in Union Station, the train station in L.A. shooting. And sure enough, late in the morning, he showed up. And David Leland, you know, knew him fairly well. And they put a broom in his hand and a janitor's outfit, and they had George just sweep across the floor. He's in the film. There he is. And I had a Gibson J45 guitar in my trailer, which I would travel with. And I went over to George and I sat down in a booth, and the photographer got a picture of me listening to George talk, because George was the only one talking. He was the only one who could speak at that moment, because I couldn't. And I remember him saying, "Have you been to Disneyland?" You know, and I just trying to get me to form words. And I was just in awe of this guy and what he had gone through and been through, that level of fame, which, you know, maybe there are people now who can relate. But when the Beatles hit, it changed the world. And these four guys, I mean, I don't know how you prepare for that. And yet George seemed to come out of it, you know, as something he did and not something that defined him now or controlled him or anything. He was just sitting in this booth, you know, late in the morning, asking an actor if he'd been to Disneyland. That was it. And I stumbled out an answer. And then I asked him, I said, "Would you mind signing my guitar?" And he said, "No, I'd be happy to." And so I said, "Look, we got 100 extras here and we're going to break for lunch. So how about we go in this back room and I'll get the guitar in there and you can sign it." And so he did that. And we went into this room and I brought it in, and it was Alan Havey, who was an actor in the show with me, and Ben Myron, the producer. It was just the three of us. And George signed it. And I got it right here. And George signed it. Show you here. I know it's audio, but
wow.
He signed it right there. And he said, "I'll put a little mystic symbol on it for you." And he squiggles this little thing. And then on this guitar, he flipped it over. And then on this guitar, he just looked at me and he started doing this. "Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, it seems like years since it's been here."
That is fantastic. You had a private concert with George Harrison.
And he played that, and then he played a Hoagie Carmichael song, and then he played All Along the Watchtower. He did 20 minutes. And he knew he was giving us something. He knew that he was giving us this gift that we would talk about forever. And it was, he was giving it to us. It was really cool. Really. It was a great lesson in fame and how to maybe use it to give something to others, you know, versus just take, take, take. It was a very giving thing of him to do, and I never forgot that.
I have the luxury and the privilege of teaching them every fall on the Jersey Shore at Monmouth University. And the first thing I tell the students is, this is a human story. These are about real people. One of them, several are going to die young. I mean, John Lennon was barely, he was 40 for 2 months. And of course, we know now, right? 40 is nothing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. And another guy's going to die of cancer at a young age, you know, Stu, Brian, you know, et cetera. This is a real story with real tragedy. Friendships will be torn asunder. Some won't be repaired. But at the heart of it all is this great and this enduring music.
And that's what that Peter Jackson Get Back documentary film, whatever you call it, did. What is it, 9 hours long?
Yeah.
But I had friends who go, oh my God, it's so boring. I'm going, no. Every second of it, it's like you are inside the creative process, which is a mess. And they embrace the mess. It can be so frustrating writing a play, writing a song, or doing a role, and it just, you're not getting it. And the frustration and the anger and of not being able to do what you want to do. They were so patient with themselves. You know, the problems they had to do with the fact that Brian was suddenly gone, and, you know, four people had to make each and every decision. That's just a recipe for disaster. And, you know, and George was kind of looking to get his own stuff out there. But watching them go into that studio with nothing and just going, well, move the date. We don't have them yet. Move the date. And they just sat there. And I think George Harrison said, we need to get back to what we were doing before. And then the next morning, McCartney walks in with Get Back.
And how about that scene, right, where he strums it out of midair?
Yeah. 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 And the long and winding road, sitting over there, and Mal comes up, and him knowing it's that kernel of a song or a play or a whatever. You've got it. You don't know where it's going yet, but now you're searching. You're heading in a direction towards Get Back or towards Long and Winding Road, and that kind of embracing of the next possible idea is all over that documentary. And it taught me a lot about having the patience to keep digging. You know, it's not futile, it's not in vain. I mean, sometimes you hit a dead end and you go, okay, all right, well, never mind. And they did that too in Get Back. They would toss things away, or they just start playing Buddy Holly, or they start playing blues, or they start just something to get them just kind of in that room of, where's the next idea going to come from? There it is. Chasing it. And it either had legs or it didn't. And when it did, that was when it got thrilling. And as the documentary kept going, they would get more and more and more. I wonder if some of that was because of a deadline. I get up against deadlines. A lot of artistic people get up against deadlines, and then they can go. It's almost like gun to the head.
A deadline fever, right? And
yeah, and I think they had a little bit of that, or maybe they were just winnowing down, but I found it fascinating, just fascinating, and knowing what to leave in and what to leave out.
I'll throw another one at you too, which I find so fascinating about that moment. So they came up with the idea of Getting Back when they shot the Hey Jude Revolution videos, and they got the idea that maybe they'd want to play live again. So they show up on January 2nd, 1969, and as Paul said, we've got to rehearse and write new material. I hear that, and I think to myself, are you joking? The number one album, when they do this, is the White Album. It has 30 new songs on it. Surely some of those would be worth rehearsing and playing in this, you know, these concerts that never really happened, right? This tour, whatever it was going to be, these shows in the middle of the ocean or the desert or what have you. They had the number one album one of the most original albums of all time.
Yes, it was.
So what is that? Is it just the rage for creativity that's already in their rearview mirror, a rearview mirror that's only looking back 30, 40 days? It came out on November 22nd, 1968. I mean, some people are still just getting it.
I think there's something to artists, maybe not less so in music, because everybody wants to hear your hits. But certainly as an actor and as a playwright, I can go, all right, go, I just did that. I wrote the end. What's next? Well, don't you want to, you know, go back over and maybe do another story about those characters? No, I want new. What's brand new? I want to jump off a different cliff. I think there's something to the what's next. What am I going to do next? They did that. They already did that.
Yeah.
What are we going to do next is, you know, it's very intoxicating. And it's also dangerous and frustrating. And, you know, what's next may not be nearly as good as the White Album. But I have a feeling those guys were going, you know, we can write anything at this point, and it's going to be great. And then McCartney and Lennon would probably, you know, really, you know, no, we'll slow down. Let's do better here. Certainly McCartney. And Ringo was kind of going, let me know when you need me. And George was going, can we do a couple of my songs? You know, but and that's where you can see the McCartney kind of take over and Lennon take over. But McCartney mostly going, okay, somebody's got to drive the bus here, the creative bus. And so this is what we're going to work on next. How about we do that? You know, you could see him. Somebody's got to be the leader. And Paul did that as they kind of Baha'd their way to 14 new songs. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, Paul was George Martin called him the convener, which I think makes sense in the artistic equation of the Beatles.
Yeah, you get a feeling that George would have kind of arrived on George Harrison time. Lennon, who knew where he'd be? And Ringo was going, nobody told me. So yeah, Paul had to be, you could tell, Paul was the one going, follow me this way. Yeah.
Yeah. You said earlier that Sgt. Pepper was a moment for you. What was different? I mean, the beauty of all these records, right, is when each one appears, it's different. It is a step forward into new terrain. But that one seemed to have been a kind of a new jumping off point for you.
Yeah, and only, I mean, the cover, the album cover was just jumped out of the discount record vinyl shop that we had in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was like, what is this? There was something so different about it, the sound of it, but also, you know, maybe sometime, and I don't know enough about the music of that period, except what I knew, but the timing of it, we were probably in a lot of Cream and, what year did Sgt. Pepper come out?
May, June, 67.
67. So you've got, you know, Strawberry Alarm Clock, you got the Cow Sills, you got the Monkees, but it just was so different than anything else. The folk scene, Dylan. And I wonder if Sgt. Pepper was after Dylan sat down with Lennon.
Oh, yes.
And sure. Said, you guys need to write better songs than that, you know, I want to hold your hand stuff. You're better than that kind of thing, right? And maybe Sgt. Pepper was partly a result of that conversation, I'm guessing at this point. And that freed them up to chase anything. As long as it was different than what they were doing before, chase it. Put it on the album.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Do you ever feel that way in your own work when you've played such an array of roles? Do you Do you think about doing something purely because it's different?
Oh, it's the driving force ever since Newsroom. It's been the driving force. I mean, I'm 69 now, and I have been trying to fail for the last 10 years. I have been risking failure every time out. I'm going, surely this will be the one where they go, he's gone too far. And it's the challenge of doing something you haven't done before. It's the challenge of risking failure and having to figure it out. I've said to several things, I've said yes without a clue as to how I was going to do it. Godless was that. To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, one, I'm not going to turn that down on Broadway with Aaron Sorkin. No, yeah. But not a clue how I was going to even attempt to make you forget about Gregory Peck.
Right.
I mean, I did a 60 Minutes interview before we opened, and Steve Croft asked me, he said, you know, Gregory Peck, you're going up against, it's one of the great iconic performances in the history of cinema. And I said, well, it's either the definitive Atticus Finch or he's the only guy who got to do it. And I can't go on stage unless I think he's the only guy who got to do it. And so that got me on stage. And then Aaron and Bart Scheer, the director, and I, we just, this is what our version of what Atticus Finch was, which was a small town lawyer who didn't do anything controversial except sit on his porch, read the paper, and, you know, raise his kids with Calpurnia's help. That's all he was, just a small town lawyer. He wasn't Gregory Peck. He wasn't on Mount Rushmore. I mean, Peck from the get-go is this larger than life Atticus Finch. And we made him smaller. And then by the end of the
play, is he's what, accepting produce from one of his clients in the film.
Yeah. And then the judge in the play, which Aaron, you know, took liberties so that we could do this more kind of smaller version who then grew into Atticus Finch. The judge comes over and has to talk him into taking the Tom Robinson case. And then Aaron wrote a scene where Atticus goes to the jail to visit Tom Robinson and to say that I'm your lawyer now, but I need to know a little bit about you and what happened. And it doesn't go well. It doesn't go well. And it's not until the trial and the closing argument that you see Atticus see what's happening and rise up against it in one of the great, one of those great Aaron Sorkin speeches that is the closing argument of Atticus Finch in the play. And I did that for a year, 8 times a week, never missed a show. And every night that closing argument, I turned to the audience about 2/3 of the way through it. First time I'm looking directly at 1,400 of the most sophisticated theater goers in the world at the Schubert Theater, and I would shame them. I treated them as the jury. They didn't move. I had people come back going, I was pinned against my seat. And every night that would happen for a year.
Well, and if I may say, I mean, that's what made that production so moving, because it's not just about 1961, it's about now.
About now.
Which I would even say the same thing. I thank you for the opportunity to watch A Man in Full in advance. It's about right now. I mean,
it's about right now. It was
really from the buzzer.
It's right now. It's very much right now.
That scene, I'll tell you, I that had me pinned against the wall, because I'm watching you bring to life this figure who should be listening to everything they're saying, but he's off on his wavelength. And it goes on right on through the pilot, right? I mean, right on through the episode at the end with Peepgrass in his little apartment.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah. How dare you call the note for $800 million? How dare you? Don't you know who I am? This bigger than life version that he sees in the mirror until he doesn't, and they're going to take the money away, and Yeah, it's certainly relevant today. Very relevant today.
Yeah. Some of the best art is about how we live now, right? And how did you approach then bringing that guy to life?
Well, I had a sense that Charlie Croker was a little bit timeless, or at least relevant to today, in the bombastic kind of, I'm richer than you and therefore more important and bigger than you. I mean, we certainly are living with that today. So I thought it was timely. I thought David E. Kelly did a great job of adapting the book and putting it into now, the present. And I read the book, and he was described by Tom Wolfe as larger than life. He had a Georgia accent that at times was indecipherable. You couldn't under, it was so thick. When he decided to go Baker County, Baker County, I tell you, I'll go down there. I mean, just let it all slur and slide around. That was fun. But he was also big, and he lived big, and he was loud, and he was, and the camera is less is more. And so as an actor, you're going in. I told David and Regina King, I said, I'm coming in big. I'm coming in. You might want to back the camera up. I'm just saying, Charlie's going to be coming into the room. And if he's in a close-up, it doesn't matter. Not to him. You know, Charlie's in charge kind of thing, which is a different kind of, just let him go. And there were times that I would be done. And I would ask the camera operator real quietly, did I just crack the lens? Just check the lens. Just check to see if I cracked it. That's all I'm asking. And I kept waiting also. I mean, when I came in the first few days, we were doing that early meeting in the first episode with Bill Camp, Tom Pelfrey, and I came in that big, and I waited for Regina King, who has won an Oscar, by the way. As Regina, the director, I was waiting for her to come over and go, really good, absolutely love it. Let's do one where we turn it down. And it never came. Never came. And I'm going, well, okay. This is either, the agent's going to go, what were you thinking? Or, oh my God, you got away with it. So that was the fun of it, the challenge of it. Can I make a guy that larger than life, still believable, have a heart, be a human being? You know, that's that, the great ones, Jack Lemmon, Alan Arkin, Peter Sellers, those guys who could go big, but you still believed them. That's the magic trick. It was a great challenge and great fun.
Oh, it's good stuff. I just, I was glued to it. I absolutely was. You mentioned earlier that for you, the newsroom was this kind of turning point.
Mm-hmm.
That you were going to just go all out from this point forward and take different kinds of risks than perhaps you had before. Why that project? I remember it so vividly because I was so, I mean, I was excited. It was you, it was Sorkin. That's all I need to know, right? The dialogue's going to be something else.
Yeah, I had been floundering for about 10 years. The career just wasn't going where I wanted to go. The offers I was getting were, I didn't want to do those roles. I went back to the theater. I did a play off Broadway called Blackbird that I ended up doing on Broadway later. It was a real tough play about a pedophile who's confronted by the girl who's now 27 years old. And she wants some closure. It was a harrowing play. I did God of Carnage with Jim Gandolfini, Marcia Gay Harden, Hope Davis. That was a big hit. But I wasn't the camera. I wasn't getting what I wanted in TV and film. And then I think Aaron might have seen God of Carnage. I'm not sure. But we heard about his project, that HBO, Aaron Sorkin, a show about a newsroom. And I loved Aaron. I mean, the West Wing, I told him, I said, I watch West Wing to watch the writing. The acting's great, but I'm watching the writing.
And
the
we can go back earlier, right, to Sports Night. Even Sports Night is, that thing's on fire. Remember that show?
Yeah, I do. I didn't hook into that at all. I mean, it was West Wing, and then I just didn't pick up on Sports Night. But Aaron had said, when he saw Network that was written by Paddy Chayefsky, and he has said that, and I've said it before, but it's that Paddy was a big influence on Aaron, and I love that movie, and I could go, yep, that's what I'm interested in doing, where you've got William Holden and Faye Dunaway in the room, but there's someone else in the room as well, and that's Paddy Chayefsky. There's three people in that room. So yeah. That's what you get the sense of with Aaron Sorkin. I got that sense with Woody Allen. I got that sense with Preston Sturges. They're in the room, in the story, and you want them there, just like you want the author of a really good book to be on every page. I want that voice.
For Ned Beatty, right? Paddy Chayefsky was in that room. You're mucking with the primal forces of the universe, you know?
Yeah, just... I mean, you when as an actor, when you see that kind of writing, you just go, you just hope you remember everything you've ever learned because you're going to need it. And that's what Newsroom became for me. And originally, we were going to shoot the pilot in about 10 days. And that greatest, it's not the greatest country in the world speech was not in the script.
And this
in the
is
pilot, the original pilot. Yeah, the original pilot. We were, the scene started where I'm walking into the office and we are all referring to what happened at Northwestern. We don't see it. And Aaron said, we need to see it. I'm going to hand you a speech in a couple days and we're going to shoot that. Okay. Which, you know, I'm excited. It's Aaron. I'm already on the show. I mean, it's Aaron Sorkin and the writing in every scene is kind of, oh, I mean, you're like riding a verbal roller coaster, but now I'm getting a speech. And I've stood next to a lot of A-list people over my career who got a speech, who got the moment. And I'm one of the supporting guys going, good for you, chief, you know, just, you know. And now it's, and then when it came in and he handed it to me, I knew, he said, can you do this? And I said, I've been waiting 35 years for this speech. And I went back to my little cheap hotel and, you know, 10 days later we were shooting it. And I spent that 10 days going over it like an athlete goes over the playbook, the reps, so that when I walked on that stage, I knew that I had to hit it out of the park because one, I knew it was a big career defining moment that if I did, it would probably buy me 10 years. And it was also in the first 10 minutes of the first episode. So that was the hook, get you to watch. And on the day we shot it, number 2, 3, and 4 at HBO showed up. Scott Rudin, the New York producer, flew in from New York. Aaron was there. Sam Waterston, Tom Sadowski, and Olivia Munn drove out an hour and a half outside of LA to the College of the Canyons where we were shooting, which had purple seats to, look like Northwestern. And they wanted to see it. As Sadowski said, I wanted to see what kind of show we were in and what was going to be demanded of the actors, you know. Am I just going to go out there and flounder through it and we'll fix it in editing? Or am I going to rise to the occasion? And Tom knows all about that. So does Sam from being in the theater. You know, on opening night, when you hit that big speech and you're the star, it's got to be a home run.
Oh, and it was. I remember seeing it when it premiered. It was a mic drop. I mean, it still is. I've watched it again.
I mean, it still is. It will outlive me and Aaron. And I hit it. I hit a home run in the first take. And Aaron came over and said, you're pitching a no-hitter. I'm not going to talk to you, and walked away. And then we made an adjustment on the second half, and then that's what it was. And everybody knew we had a show. At that moment, after that first take, everybody knew. As Sam Waterston later said, that's when I knew I had a job. Which was true. He and I both thinking that.
That's beautiful. And you're right. It's a verbal roller coaster. I remember watching the episode and really not knowing that was coming. You know, because I knew the setting and how those moments typically go, what we're watching, right? People on a stage, et cetera. And it goes into that incredible monologue. It's
well, you expect him to go, why is this the greatest country in the world, Mr. McAvoy? Well, here are the 15 reasons, and I'm going to give you a great speech about why this is the greatest country in the world. That's the speech that you expect.
Yeah.
And then Sorkin goes, I got something else in mind.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And then in the second half, you know, Greg Mottola came up and he said, maybe a little more melancholy, wishing it could be in the second half of the speech. And that's where you see McAvoy, I find a lower gear and just drop into, but we could be this, we could be that, you know, that kind of, just kind of like, and it's so relevant, especially today.
Well, certainly. Right. You mentioned Woody Allen, and the first time I saw you on any screen was Purple Rose of Cairo. And I remember my mother said, this is a movie you need to see. It's about making art. And it's about art literally leaping off of the screen, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, being a good boy, I did what mom said. And I went and watched it. And it's still just, for me, it has a special place. How did you approach that role?
I had done Terms of Endearment at the age of 28. Maybe a Marie with Sissy Spacek supporting role. You know, the career was there. It was certainly moving forward, and I was in the movies. And then we got a call that Woody Allen wanted to meet me. And at the time, you know, in the 80s, Woody was a premier American filmmaker, you know.
You're only a few years removed from Annie Hall and Manhattan?
Annie Hall. And they had just done Broadway Danny Rose, I think. Zelig. I mean, all that stuff. And I had read his books, Without Feathers and Getting Even. I was going, well, this is the art of comedy writing right here. And I remember that reading that was in college. But, you know, as an actor at that time, you go meet Woody and, you know, long story, but I got the part. It was just surreal. It was just, you're trying not to get fired. Because at the time, and Woody would do this, there would be a well-known person playing a role for 6 weeks, and Woody would cut his or her stuff together, and it wouldn't work, and he'd pay him off and then reshoot. He had that kind of power and freedom. I mean, I think we reshot about at least 35-40% of the movie. Just didn't like the lighting or the look or the writing or the performance or whatever it might have been. And he got to come back and redo it. And, you know, like another draft kind of thing. So you're just staying at your best and trying to, although just please, again, let me remember everything I've ever learned now. And it changed my life. That movie changed my life because it came out and the reviews were good. They didn't dismiss me. And I remember going to meet Mike Nichols for Heartburn soon after that. And I went to Mike's apartment and nice to meet you and great. And he was very nice. And this is the part and this is what I'm thinking of doing with it. Yeah, okay, yeah, well, I'd love to. Do you want me to read a scene or anything? He goes, good enough for Woody, good enough for me. And you're going, okay, I just bought some time here. You know? So, yeah, that one changed my life.
I've heard other actors say something very similar to the remark you've made a couple of times, that this will buy me 10 years. This will allow me to have option A, B, C later. This is something you think about,
It's,
even.
I think it's a real thing. I heard it when Jack Nicholson, when Lorne Michaels asked Jack Nicholson, why he did the Joker in Batman. And Jack said, because there's a whole generation of kids out there who don't know who the fuck I am. And you're going, oh, sometimes that drives decisions. But you can just feel the bounce. You suddenly have street cred in Hollywood. And if you're somebody like me who's living in Michigan trying to avoid all of that, bang, suddenly you're in something that they're talking about you and you're not even there. You're not even available to come in and have a little meeting and have a look and see. And not even, you're not going to other people's premieres and lingering too long at the microphone. You're in Michigan. And now you're in something where good enough for Woody or good enough for Aaron Sorkin or, and even doing Dumb and Dumber with Jim. I mean, I had agents telling me you really shouldn't do this. We're going to stop this from happening. With all due respect, he's going to blow you off the screen. And I said, well, that's probably true. I've seen his work and I wouldn't be the first one, but I think I know how to work with him. And I knew that Jim wanted to work with an actor, not another comedian. Another comedian would just try to top him. The old yes and thing. But Jim wanted an actor who would make him listen. So I knew that. And I also knew that I had scenes that the toilet scene, the tongue on the pole scene, and Jim's not in those. So I said, I'm going to score in those. I know I'm going to score in those. Unless they cut him out of the movie, I'm going to score. So, and I know how to work with Jim, I think. And it turned out I did. And the smartest thing I did was we want Jim Carrey to be Jim Carrey. And I don't want to be an anchor on that. But let him lead. He's gonna anyway, as a solo performer for decades, I mean, that's how he's wired. So let Lloyd be the leader and Harry be the follower. So I became this puppy on a leash, even a half second delay. I would put in a delay. Harry, what? Just slow out of the blocks. And that, when Lloyd went through the door, I just followed. And what are we doing now? That kind of thing. And so that suddenly we have this kind of blend of the leader and the follower, and then Harry stands up to him and all that stuff. That made it work. And the fact that I think he's funny, we had a great time on stage, on camera and off, and with the Farrelly brothers. It was just a great set. Great set.
Did they ever come back, the agents, and say you were right?
No, I mean, look, they weren't wrong. They were trying to keep me on the serious actor path who one day would get an Oscar nomination for something. That was my path with these particular guys, and they weren't wrong. This was going, our target audience was 12-year-old boys, and they were going, this is a mistake. You're making a mistake. And I had one agent who's now my manager who said, well, he wants to do it, so if it doesn't work, it's on him. And then I did a bunch of indie films that no one saw, no one. And I said, I needed to be in a movie that someone actually sees. And that's what Arachnophobia came around. I said, I'm happy to do that. And I got Frank Marshall was the directing, and I had a great time with Frank and a good group. And you got the whole Spielberg Amblin Entertainment thing behind you. It was first class. It was fun.
I've heard people describe, and I think about it a lot because I write books, and I've heard people say that writing anything for any long period of time is getting on a path, on a journey for which you will never arrive. Is acting like that too, where there's something out there on the horizon, there's a glint of it, and you're always working toward, is it like that where you are on this journey, you've been describing this journey, and but it doesn't necessarily have a final station, even though I guess life does, but right, it doesn't have that place where you say, ah, yes, I've arrived, thank you, good night, I'm going back to my guitars now.
Yeah, well, first of all, yes, it can feel like you never finish it, you just abandon it, that line, as an actor. And I would kick myself after shooting a scene going, oh, I should have done this, should have done that. There was that. Then I got rid of that when I worked with Clint Eastwood. Clint does one take. One. Not two, one. And that's it. And you're told that, and you know that, and you go in there, and that's exactly what happens. So sometimes it's just making it happen in front of the camera for the first time, believably, and that's enough. That's different than stage, but that when I worked with Clint, I said, okay, then just throw it at the lens for this take, and in the best world, and I remember feeling this in Newsroom, the best version of that is when you do several takes and they ask you if you're done and you don't remember what you did or how you did it. You were so in the moment between action and cut, you know, like Clint, I'm making it happen for the first time. So you're so there that you don't have the judge sitting on your shoulder analyzing how you're doing and then asking for another take and then asking for another one. And then ask, you know, that person is gone. Clint did that for me. In theater on Broadway, it's 100 performances. I kind of picked that number out of a hat, but when I was doing Mockingbird for that year, I got to about 3 months or so in, and I was at this is a Thursday night, it's the 100th show. Oh, wow. Yep, I've pretty much stopped trying to fix everything. I've stopped exploring pretty much, and I kind of, this is who he is, and this is how I'm doing him. So that happened. You still fiddle, but it's, you know, you've arrived somewhere. The writing is, you can, for some reason, you can always rewrite. Always change a line here or there. And I think sometimes, and I've learned this at the theater, being a writer director, and, you know, I write plays for the Purple Rose Theater Company in Michigan, and you give it to the actors, and there is, you want to look, Arthur Miller said this, I look forward to seeing what my work inspires in others. And when you give a play to the actors, I mean, yeah, if they're wrong and they're stupid and they're doing, I need more lines here because I want a bigger, you know, that I don't have that problem with the Purple Rose. But if you can give it to actors who will then kind of bring their own physicality or their own comedic timing or their own whatever to it, you could just watch it bloom. It's really cool. It's really cool. And you get in there and start doing details and stuff like that and tightening and all of that, especially if it's a comedy. But then you let it go. Squid and the Whale, it's the same thing. Squid and the Whale, I remember seeing that movie at the New York Film Festival. There were 2,000 people in this huge theater, and we were pushed out in the royal box. We all waved to everybody. And then we went away, and I stayed there in the royal box. That's what I did. And I watched down because the movie started, and 2,000 people turned to the screen. And the lights went down, and I was not a part of that. And I'm going, oh, it's theirs. It's theirs now. So it's done. It's done. You know, that I felt the finish on that.
And that's a truism, right? Because whether it's the Beatles, you know, recording their records, or, you know, a play or a movie or something that we write, there is that moment where, like it or not, you are now collaborating with people you will never know, who are taking the baton and they're making meaning in their own minds. And
Yeah.
You have to let go in a way.
Yeah, get out of the way, basically, and not continue to try to fiddle. That was the beauty of the Beatles, too, and Get Back. I mean, those guys, they were very, when they got to the song and they recorded it and they did a take that they liked, that was it. They had arrived. And they had captured it, and it was what it was at the time that they did it, and that was good enough. In fact, that was everything.
Everything Fab Four is presented by Salon.com, the premier news, politics, innovation, and arts website. For more information, visit everythingfab4.com, where you can learn more about our podcast and my latest Beatles-related books, including John Lennon 1980, The Last Days in the Life, and Living the Beatles Legend, the previously untold story of beloved Beatles roadie Mal Evans. The Everything Fab Four theme song, Seize the Day, is provided courtesy of Black Rabbit, the high-octane Beatles cover band and innovative psychedelic rock project from Rockaway Beach, Queens, in New York City. Like what you heard today on Everything Fab Four? Be sure to subscribe, give us a rating, and recommend the show to your friends. Plus, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at EF4 Podcast. Distributed by Salon, Everything Fab Four is a Wonderwall production. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.